Risky Business. Risky Business. Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to this week's show, brought to you by Microsoft. I'm just back from a quick holiday to Japan, the world's cutest country. You know, it's funny, they've gone from lopping the heads off emaciated prisoners of war to painting Pokemon characters on the sides of their trains in just over 60 years. It's really quite incredible. And I'll tell you another thing, if we could design software the way Japanese design their bullet trains and toilet seats, you'd see a lot fewer coding fuck-ups, I'm not kidding. Bit of a weird place though, you know you're somewhere different when you order a cappuccino and they ask you if you would like it hot or cold. And breakfasts can be a little bit odd as well. Hey, does anyone want more egg paste with their sea gel? Anyway, on to this week's topics, and ZDNet Australia editor Munir Kataria is back from his holiday in Canada, and he joins us for this week's news segment. That'll be fun. It's been a few weeks since Munir's been on the show. And in this week's feature interview, we'll chat to Peter Gutman from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. You know those e-passports with the cryptographically sophisticated wireless RFID chips in them? Well, it's a funny story really, but they're completely insecure. So Peter will be along soon to tell us how you can create your very own Elvis Bin Laden e-passport. Speaking of New Zealanders, KiwiCon has finalised its list of speakers, and the organisers would greatly appreciate it if you would register your interest in attending. And it's not so that they can dispatch your particulars to the US Homeland Security Department and have you placed on the cyber terror watch list for the rest of your living days. So please head to KiwiCon.org to enter your name, address, date of birth, mother's maiden name and credit card number. And don't worry about your IP address and a list of open services. They've automated that part of the process for you. It's choice, bro. In this week's sponsor interview, Microsoft's Jeffrey Jones joins us on the line from the USA. Jones is the guy who prepared a report on the vulnerability count in Windows versus other operating systems. It was the Vista One Year On report, which was released in November 2007. Those who remember its release will also remember it was quite controversial at the time. Anyway, Jeff is along soon in that sponsor interview, but first up, it's time to bring Munir Kataria from ZDNet Australia back on to talk about some of the stories you can find on zdnet.com.au/news. And Munir, some students in the United States who are due to give a bit of a talk on hacking subway cards, they've been gagged by the US judiciary.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. It's something that we've heard quite a lot of recently, haven't we? I mean, there was something going on with the Oyster card earlier on, but yet they've been told that they can't do their presentation. They were supposed to do it on Friday, weren't they?
Yeah, now it was something to do with Boston's, you know, they were going to do it at, what was it, Black Hat or DEF CON, one of the Vegas cons,
yeah.
And, you know, it was either, I think it was the government, the state government that ran the public transport network there said, well, hang on, you can't give a presentation that'll show people how to get free rides on our transport system. So, unbelievably, they've actually been able to get a total gag order on these kids who are going to do the talk.
Do you reckon, do you know what system they're using? Is there anything to do with that? Was it the MyFair smart card, the Oyster card and stuff, which I know we talked about a month or so ago?
This is a different one, I think. It's called the Charlie card. But yeah, there's a lot of research, a lot of very interesting stuff going into contactless RFIDs and things like that. So today's feature guest is Peter Gutman talking about the e-passports. So yeah, very interesting area of research. And it's interesting in this case, I can see it from both points of view. I think it's reasonable. It's almost reasonable for the government to want a bit more time to figure out what these guys are going to actually talk about so that they might want to fix it.
Totally. I mean, how easy is it going to be? Is anybody going to be able to just go and, you know, do this and bypass the system?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I don't think anyone really knows the details yet, which is why they want some time. But it's always a shame to see people actually gagged and forbidden from speaking something, especially in a country like the United States where the right to free speech is supposed to be enshrined in the Constitution, you know?
Right.
Unless you're talking about something that might harm the government, you know, in which case, yeah.
Hey, look, mate, one thing we know for sure is that as soon as you do one of these gag orders, then suddenly everybody wants to know about it. Just look back, Cisco 2005, Michael Lin.
Yeah, everyone
that
loves
it. Hysterical, right? Just good trying to stop this guy from doing his presentation. He eventually did it. And next thing you know, everybody in the world knew what was going on. And this Oyster card thing, same thing. As soon as you try and gag it, then suddenly it's the most publicity you could ever possibly imagine.
Well, this is the Charlie card one, but it looks like, yeah. I mean, we're all obviously going to have to focus a little bit more on the sort of physical, you know, contactless RFID stuff, because it's a topic that's certainly heating up.
Definitely.
Somewhat unexpectedly, I got to say. I if I had have been asked last year if I thought it would be a big issue this year, I doubt I would have known. Now, in this next piece, and, you know, it's not technically a security piece, but it's just funny as hell, which is, I suppose, unless you're a conservative. But in one of our states in Australia, the two conservative parties have merged into the Liberal National Party, and a cyber squatter actually got a hold of liberalnationalparty.org and has been, you know, running a forum there where he's arguing for the legalization of marijuana. Which is kind of funny if you know Queensland politics.
Yeah, so I don't quite know quite what's going to happen here. But then this guy has already been done. Apparently he's well known as the BindyOwen.com guy because he did a similar kind of stunt when Steve Irwin passed away.
Yeah. So he's got a habit of registering these domains. But you'd think a political party might register its own name, .org, you know. And the funny thing is here, he actually registered it after they'd announced the name of the party.
That's not so smart, actually. That is very, very silly indeed.
Do you reckon they're fit to run Queensland? I don't know.
We'll let the listeners decide that one, I reckon.
Yes. But there you go. So if you want to hear about this guy, what's his name? It's Wayne Smith. If you want to go and read Wayne Smith's opinions on legalising marijuana, head to liberalnationalparty.org. Okay, next up, here we go. A story running under what I would have thought is a fairly sensational headline here, Munir, which is a researcher blackmails son, Nokia, which is about a Polish security researcher who claims to have found multiple flaws in mobile Java, and he wants €20,000 in return for full details of the vulnerabilities.
That's right, yeah, a guy called Adam Gaudiak.
Gaudiak?
I don't quite know if that's pronounced correctly, but yeah, a Polish guy. Apparently, he's found a whole load of issues there in the implementation of mobile Java, and he won some €20,000 for it. And apparently, Sun or Nokia have not got back to him yet. I'm wondering why he didn't just flog it to someone like Tipping Point and probably given him $15,000 for it, right?
Yeah, I'm wondering if he actually did approach Tipping Point or iDefense first. But, you know, he's got 14,000 lines of code that he's written and a 178-page report. So
yeah.
I don't think it's something that he wants to part with for free. I don't know if it amounts to blackmail, though, Munir. I've got to say, I'm surprised to see that sort of headline gracing the electronic pages of ZDNet. I mean, if he wants a quick $20,000, he could just sue you.
I guess so.
You know what I mean?
Went up last week. My defense is I was in Canada.
Yeah, well, that was it. I was in a different hemisphere.
No, but I mean, this guy comes up with a good point. He goes, if the vendors prefer to throw their money at lawyers instead of spending them to improve their products, then that's up to them.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think we're going to see more of this sort of thing with security researchers going direct to the vendor. I don't think he's threatening to release this stuff to the public or zero day it or anything like that. I think he's just, you know, wants to try to recoup some cash, having done all that work.
Don't you think he would have been better off, though, not doing it publicly and just going up to them quietly and saying, hey, guys, look at this, I've got this. I mean, you know, this apparently is used in 100 million devices.
Yeah, I don't think he's the sharpest tool in the shed when it comes to business nous. You know, I think you could certainly find more refined ways, shall we say, of making money out of that sort of information.
The other thing he says is that his overall target is to get €1 million. So, I mean, even if he gets his $20,000, he's going to have to
He's going to have to work harder, isn't he? Yeah, he's going to have to do, what, another 50 of them? Who knows what he's
got? I don't even want to do the math.
Who even knows what he's got in the sack, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he might have quite a few. So see who's next. Oh, now just briefly, the Australian Law Reform Commission has released its report recommending Australia introduces data breach disclosure laws. No surprise there. There was a preliminary report out quite a long time ago. But apparently it's going to take about 18 months to get into legislation.
That's right. So definitely no data breach laws until 2010, which is a shame. It's a long way away. I think we need them.
But it rolls around.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, how long has California had that? I think it's been about 5 years now.
Oh, it's been something like that, yeah. And it certainly makes...
Yeah, it completely changed the industry. I mean, since then, we've had all of the, you know, the security firms merging with the data firms and the storage firms and whatever. And, you know, it could change the industry completely once it does come.
And it makes life for the media much more fun because then we know who's who's lost data and we get to tease them about it.
Hey, but look at the UK. I mean, I don't think the UK have them yet, do they? I think they're still waiting to get them. But there's been a lot of exposure over there.
I'm not really sure about the UK. I know that the government has to, but I'm not sure if it's actually trickled into the private sector. I would have thought it did, but I don't cover the UK beat, so
no,
I'm not sure.
You know, I've read a few stories about them, and I know that our sister site down there has been saying that, yes, we need the full laws, but we've had a lot about their government there, and they've had all sorts of issues. So, oh, come on, it's got to be a good thing. We do need them in, and we want them in quick. I don't want to wait until 2010, but I guess we'll just have
to. But, you know, look, it's better that they actually draft the legislation, have a real good look at it, instead of writing, thou shalt not disclose data on the back of a napkin, and then putting a seal on it. You know what I mean? You don't want to create laws too quickly, Mun. You know, you want to make sure there's a little bit of thought that's gone into them.
It's true.
Now, another story in brief, a server has been discovered that contained 50 gigabytes of stolen user account and financial details, including 9,000 bank and credit card account credentials and almost 500,000 user account passwords.
That's right.
Apparently, this is great.
It's a central control point for CoreFlood, a password-stealing Trojan that's been around since 2001.
So in that time, it looks like it's actually got quite a lot. And I think that's actually that's not showing all data since 2001. That's only the recent stuff. So that gives you an idea of just how full on these botnets are and how much data. I mean, that's a lot of plain text.
That's a fair amount, yeah.
Encyclopedia Britannica, eat your heart out. Remember when that used to be the measure of data? Was like how many encyclopedias
right.
you could fit onto a CD?
Yeah, how many is that? How many are there in 50 gig?
I don't know.
Reader's writing.
It's a lot, yes.
Yeah.
It's a lot. Now, this is kind of an old story, but we both missed it because we were both overseas on our holidays, which was nice, up in the warm northern hemisphere.
Yeah,
it's a little bit chilly back here now. But these three journalists from a French security magazine got kicked out of Black Hat for sniffing the press network.
No, this was rather amusing, right? Global Security Mag. Yeah, they got done. I love this story. I love the way it's written here. And they've got, apparently the men were seen huddled over a table in two press rooms for much of the day. And they took their computer to the Wall of Sheep, which is where they have monitors that display wireless network activity.
Yeah, but they also, on the Wall of Sheep, that's where you see people's passwords, where they've gone past in plain text, you know, just to make an arse out of them. But yeah, these guys were like, yeah, sniffing everyone's data in the press network. Now, the press network at Black Hat is supposed to be off limits. You know, I mean, if you connect to a public LAN and you start flying passwords around, mate, you are fair game, you know. Mm-hmm. But considering journalists aren't, you know, specialists and stuff, they thought they'd create this sort of safe, demilitarized, wired LAN for them. So these guys, you know, it was a real no-no for them to be sniffing it. And they got marched out. You know, basically taken by the ear and kicked out of the conference and banned from all future events. So
everything from the future. I mean, that's pretty sad. They go, yeah, it was just a joke.
Yeah, ha ha. Security journalists now banned from Black Hat. And but you've got to say...
The journalists said that they wanted to educate the public about the privacy dangers when using public internet connections.
Yeah, good one, by violating other people's privacy. And, you know, it's interesting, though, to see that Black Hat has taken such strong measures against these dudes. But, you know, given that it's such a commercial event these days and there's a lot of money involved, I'm not surprised, really, that... that they want to really make the press feel good about turning up. So I think that was what happened there. But
nothing like this would ever happen at Allcert, right?
We, I won't tell you what. Let's just say a friend of mine was sniffing the wireless LAN there. And I think I mentioned this story once on the show, but there was this one person whose computer kept hitting these zero-byte GIFs on this Russian server, so it was pretty clear that they were being keylogged and they were actually on the wireless LAN at Auscert. So you see some pretty crazy stuff flying around on the wireless LANs, or so I've heard.
I remember when my first Auscert, one of the first things you said to me was, don't connect to it unless you're on a VPN.
Yeah,
that
pretty much.
For that?
That was a few years ago now, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, look, in this story, this is another oldie, but, I mean, I'm just stunned by this story. And I should mention that last piece that actually – oh, no, that was one of yours. That was a CNET story. But this next one is actually from securityfocus.com.
Right.
But Theodore, who's the guy who wrote Nmap, the Nmap security scanning tool, as featured in The Matrix –
Yes.
It's serious. There is a scene where they use Nmap. It's two or three. I can't remember. But
okay.
Yeah, very funny. Okay, the dude who runs Nmap, he's done a big scan. And believe it or not, the second most commonly open port, or one of the top four most commonly open ports, is Telnet.
Yeah, Telnet port 23. The top one is, not surprisingly, port 80 HTTP.
Yeah, now I'm just stunned by this. I'm absolutely stunned that the top four ports are HTTP, Telnet, which is port 23, SSH on 22, and HTTPS. Man, there are more open Telnet ports than SMTP ports. This is
as
freaking
a security guard, it's depressing to see Telnet open more often than SSH.
Yes, said Fedor. I mean, this is obviously default implementations that aren't managed properly, and, you know, really, that's just shocking. It's depressing. But I suppose that's good for all the blackouts out there who want to play, you know.
I guess so.
For the rest of us, I mean, when will people learn? When will they learn? The Telnet is not good.
Something we've known for a little while.
Yeah, it is something we've known for a little while. And just quickly, Munir, because it is our feature topic today, but Peter Goodman from New Zealand and a couple of other researchers have cracked the e-passports.
Yeah, that's right. This is the US paranoia basically forcing the whole world to adopt insecure passwords.
Yeah.
I mean, passports, rather.
Yeah, no, it's that seems to be what happened.
Yeah, it's interesting, because one of the guys there who's involved in this, a guy called Adam Lurie, who 4 years ago I spoke to, and I first came across him because he gave us a shout and said, hey, I know this, I've discovered this thing called blue snarfing, where, you know, Bluetooth had been badly implemented, so we went up there with a bag of mobile phones, which all had Bluetooth on. Some were visible, some were invisible. He just sat there with his laptop, and he goes, oh, you got seven phones in there, started pulling out photographs, text messages, and whatever from his laptop. It was incredible. This guy really knows what he's talking about. So,
and now he can pwn your passport.
Well, you know what? If he says he can do it, I totally believe him.
All right. And that was from Fairfax Press in New Zealand. another story from Security Focus here, which is the... now, this is very interesting. The Air Force Cyber Command, which was going to be the US government's big, you know, spooky cyber offensive force, that's actually been sort of put on hold.
Okay, so apparently Air Force Cyber Command is in a holding pattern. What is all this about, Pat?
Well, they were going to create this huge team of like 8,000 super-duper cyber warfare dudes and put them in a bunker or something, and it looks like they've actually just put those plans on hold. So the quote here is, the Secretary and Chief of Staff of the Air Force have considered delaying currently planned actions on Air Force Cyber Command to allow ample time for a comprehensive assessment of all AF cyber requirements and to synchronize AF cyber mission with other key Air Force initiatives. So it looks like either they're running behind or they're having second thoughts.
Is it going to affect any of us?
Well, it depends on whether or not a war breaks out, I guess.
maybe they know something we don't.
Or maybe they're just content to beat China in the Olympics and don't feel the need to bomb them flat. Now, in our final story here, some researchers from Mandiant have won the Race to Zero competition in Las Vegas. That was the one run by our friend Simon Howard. They set up a bunch of email gateways and had entrants sort of obfuscate very old malware and sneak it past. So there has been a winner.
Yeah, that's right. It took them just about 6 hours to do this, and they had to send... they had to fool these antivirus things to get through things like the stoned virus. Do you know the first ones I remember being infected by? It,
in 1988, yeah, that's right up there with the junkie virus.
Yeah.
It was all drugs back then.
And apparently even managed to sneak through a version of the slammer worm, which
yeah.
remember very, very well.
Now, look, I've got an interview in the can with Simon talking about this. I'm pretty sure I'll run it next week. It's just that the e-passports thing came up. And I've decided to run with that. But yeah, it is. There's some interesting lessons learned there. All I did there was obfuscate the payload in the UDP packet, because that's all Slammer was. And yeah, it got right through. But, you know, according to Simon, you know, there's some good innovations being made, more in the consumer stuff, with the behavioral detection and stuff like that. And he's just disappointed that it hasn't made its way through into the enterprise-grade stuff yet.
Yeah. I mean, one of the points of this, one of the important points of this competition was that they were only using the virus scanning component. So they weren't using any of the heuristic stuff, which if they had been using that, then I don't know if all of these would have got through.
Well, something to look forward to next year, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
All right, Munir Kataria, welcome back, and thanks a lot for coming on the show again.
Cheers, mate. It seems like it's been a very long time. Look forward to the next one.
Munir Kataria, editor of ZDNet Australia there. And you can read most of those stories on zdnet.com.au/news. But of course, we picked a couple of extras up from the Fairfax Press in New Zealand and Security Focus this week. Moving on now and to this week's feature interview. And we're talking to the University of Auckland's security researcher, Peter Goodman. Peter and two other researchers, Britain's Adam Laurie and the Dutch academic Jeroen van Beek, have figured out how to totally mess with fancy schmancy biometric passports. As it turns out, they're quite useless indeed. You can modify the data on them and pass them off as the genuine article. So all of that extra security that was supposedly going to go into our passports by putting these biometric chips on them turns out to be not quite that useful. So Peter Goodman joins me now to discuss. Peter, tell us about what you've done.
Well, it was actually a three-person effort to basically demonstrate that you could create a passport that would be accepted as valid by the reference implementation. So a lot of the stuff with this passport is that it was motivated very heavily by politics rather than security concerns. For example, the motivation for rushing out the e-passport wasn't any concerns about terrorism. It was because the US said, you need to do this by this date or we will impose travel sanctions on you, which will cost you a hell of a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So the threat model in this case wasn't terrorism, it was the Bush administration. And that's you know, the problem with this is that there's such a huge amount of politics tied up in this stuff, it's very hard to pull apart the politics from the technology. But one of the side effects of rushing this out in a hurry based on political pressure was that there were some compromises made that weren't necessarily, you know, the end result wasn't necessarily the best way of doing things.
Well, it sounds like that. I mean, isn't this stuff, I mean, okay, the data that goes onto these chips is, you know, supposed to be like an image of your face, which can be used for biometrics analysis. They're supposed to be the data on the actual photo page of the passport itself. Now, that stuff, I'm presuming, gets digitally signed by some sort of master key that is kept at the passport's office, and then it goes onto the chip. How is it possible, if they've cryptographically signed that information, for you to be able to modify it, and as we've seen, create a passport for Elvis Bin Laden?
Well, the problem with the signing, again, because all of this was rushed out under intense political pressure, it was implemented in a very hit-and-miss fashion. So there was supposed to be this thing called the PKD, or Public Key Directory, which is, as you say, a master directory of all the signing keys. And the problem is that most countries don't subscribe to this yet. In fact, it's almost impossible to find out which countries are implementing this. I had this wonderful conversation with someone from the UK at one point, where I tried to get him to give me a yes or no response. Is the UK using this? And no matter how I phrased the question, he would never give me a yes or no response.
So for a brief moment in time, you knew what it was like to be a journalist.
Right. So as far as I know, there are supposedly 10 members of this public key directory. So of all the countries in the world, there are 10 countries that are members. And supposedly there are 5 that are using it, which is Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Japan, and the USA. But again, because it's impossible to get a yes-no answer from anyone, it's really hard to say who's actually using this.
Now, does that mean that that rewriting data onto passports that are going through gantries in those countries, does that mean that these techniques will fail and that the passport will be recognised as non-genuine?
In theory, it should fail. Again, there's a related question to whether people are using the PKD, which is, are people using the electronic portion of the passport? And it's almost impossible to get a yes-no response to that either. I only know, you know, from travelling that pretty much everywhere I've gone, they've actually still read the front page of the passport. They don't seem to have read the electronic portion of it yet.
Well, I can tell you that I have been through gantries or, you know, immigration setups in the US and also in Australia, which have scanned the e-passport. Would that mean that if I had have modified that data, their crypto checking should get it and say, well, hang on, you're not Elvis Bin Laden?
Presumably it should get it. There are some related problems. You know, because you're dealing with standard software here, the software is going to have security vulnerabilities. For example, I found out when I was playing with the reference implementation that at one point I was lazy and I was just patching together bits and pieces to create a signature, and I created a signature that should have been rejected, and the software didn't recognize it as being invalid and accepted it anyway. So it's quite possible that you can do all sorts of things. And you know, Lukas Grunwald, a German researcher, showed that you can use buffer overflows in the reader software to attack the actual reader.
So you can actually put a buffer overflow exploit on the chip, and as you go through, pwn the reader.
Yeah.
I like it.
And, you know, again, one of the things I found when I was playing with it, again, I sort of assembled some patchwork of signed data, which turned out to be complete garbage, and the reader software crashed. So it's quite possible that you can actually attack the reader software.
But I imagine that there would be various different implementations of that used across the globe, or is that what you're saying, that it's all standard one solution?
There are lots and lots of different implementations, and you can see this in the chips themselves. So Adam Laurie, the guy who did the RFID portion of this passport reader stuff, has a web page where he lists all the differences. Every country has implemented their own version of it, and they all get it slightly wrong, and they're all, you know, slightly incompatible. So, for example, you can fingerprint individual passports based on the bugs in the implementations.
What do you mean by fingerprint passports by the bugs?
Well, so in theory, every passport, when you query it, is supposed to respond in the same manner and give the same response. But in practice, because the implementations are all different, they all give slightly different responses. So, for example, the passports themselves are protected by a kind of primitive cryptographic access control. So, in theory, you need to do a bit of encryption breaking to access it if you don't know the passport password or access key. Of course, the encryption key is actually printed on the front page of the passport, so it's not that hard to guess if you know the passport. But even without seeing the passport, you can tell, for example, Australian passports have certain quirks. So you can say whoever's carrying this passport is an Australian. New Zealand ones have certain quirks. US ones have certain quirks. So you can actually tell the nationality of the passport holder without having to do any encryption breaking or anything else like that.
Did you actually look at busting the encryption on the data stored on the passport so that you could create... So that you could actually, you know, completely break that encryption scheme and, you know, you could take my passport, put your picture on it, you know, both physically and on the chip, and then get it passed as valid through most gantries? Or is that really not what the research was about?
Well, you could do that if they don't check the signing key. If they simply accept whatever signing key is found on the passport, then you can do whatever you want, thus the Elvis Bin Laden passport. If they do check the signing key, then it gets quite a bit harder because they are using, you know, in theory, cryptographically strong mechanisms. You would then have to see if there's implementation bugs or something like that where it will accept an invalid signature or where you can attack the reader software itself.
And, of course, they'd vary from implementation to implementation, wouldn't
they? Yeah, so that's the thing. If you've got an attack where you can, let's say, seize control of the reader in a UK passport office, that doesn't mean that the same attack is going to work in the US.
So I guess the message here to various government guys who might be listening, I suppose the message here is that countries should really get involved in this PKD database, shouldn't they?
Well, I don't think even then. I mean, you've still got dozens of incompatible implementations, probably with their own sets of bugs. The real thing is that, you know, we have a very, very good, effective passport checking mechanism. It's called the human being standing behind the counter.
Mm.
The problem with these electronic implementations is that once people start using purely electronic implementations, then there is a temptation for the humans to say, well, the computer said they're okay, I'm just going to wave them through.
Yeah.
And the checking becomes less and less careful. And this is one of the things that security people have pointed out ever since this was first introduced, that human beings have, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of years of evolution at checking faces and detecting whether people are acting slightly funny and so on and so forth. Computers don't do that. They just see a bunch of binary data. They say, yeah, it's okay, go on through. So the thing is not to replace humans with computers.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I got to ask too, you would have heard the news that 3,000 blank UK passports were stolen in a hijacking in the UK.
Right.
What do you make of that?
Well, that's really, really scary. I mean, one of the arguments that the UK... Well, again, the UK has their own political reasons for this. They've wanted to introduce a national ID card for a long time and haven't been able to push it through politically. And so they're basically turning the passports into a national ID card, and they're pretty open about this. You know, the passport is going to become the UK's national ID card. And one of the things they've been saying is this is the most secure passport ever. So once you've got 3,000 passports stolen, and the chips on those passports were unlocked, which means you can load whatever you want onto those chips, that is a bit of a headache for the UK now, because their most secure passport ever probably isn't looking that good anymore.
Well, they'd have to really accelerate their crypto stuff, wouldn't they, so that they can tell if the data on that chip has been signed by a valid key.
Right. And also, you know, be very, very careful with their implementation, because, again, if you can exploit a buffer overflow or a bug in the verification software, you can still get around that.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, seeing that many passports going walkies?
Well, yeah, if you look at the details of the story, I mean, this wasn't some random person doing a smash and grab. This was a very, very targeted theft. The bad guys knew exactly what they were going for, and, you know, it was a very carefully executed theft. So if these passports really were the most secure passports ever, why would the bad guys go to such efforts to steal them?
That's the 3,000 passport question, Peter.
Right.
You know, I mean, you've got to wonder. I know that when you were out in Australia in May, that you sat down with some government types and had a chat to them about this under a sort of Chatham House rules scenario. How did they take it?
It wasn't so much about the passports, it was more about RFID in general. So, for example, if you've got an RFID access card for a building, it's relatively easy to clone someone's access card. And there was, I guess it was a bit of an eye-opener that people aren't generally aware just how easy it is to clone some of these RFID access cards that let you into a building.
Is cloning a passport pretty easy? I imagine it would be.
Well, the thing is, making an exact copy of what's in the passport is easy because you just basically copy it out of the existing passport into a new blank card.
Yeah, there's not much to be
supposed to be hard.
Well, that's it. You know, there's not much to be gained by cloning an existing passport. The whole idea is to modify it with a different picture or, you know, whatever, right?
Right. And that's basically what this demonstration showed, that you can modify it, and that at least some software, and in this case, you know, the reference implementation, the so-called Golden Reader tool, will accept that as genuine.
Well, I imagine too that, you know, to an intelligence service, a lot of these passports are going to be quite valuable. You know, Mossad got famously busted in New Zealand, you know, lodging all sorts of fake applications for passports. Now, I imagine a Mossad agent wanting to travel to a country like, I don't know, Libya. I don't think Libya is going to have access to that PKD database.
Right. And even then, you know, if you're talking about government intelligence agencies, these guys have really, really good computer guys in there. If there's a buffer overflow to be found in the Reader implementation, then chances are they're going to be able to find it.
So I guess these e-passports aren't as, you know, robust as we would like to think.
Well, I don't know if, you know, certainly security people have always been saying that these things aren't that robust. I think it's they're not as robust as governments have been telling us they are.
Well, wouldn't... See, the thing that frustrates me about this is it's really clear that if everyone just signed up to the correct database and checked the crypto on it, then they'd actually work.
Well, not necessarily. For example, another one of the problems, there's a whole slew of problems with these things. One of the problems is with the RFID is that it's now a contactless interface.
Mm.
So if I've got my passport in front of me, you can tell you're holding a physical artifact with my photo in it. You can tell that that's a genuine passport. With a contactless interface, all the reader knows is that something somewhere is responding and saying that I'm a passport.
Yeah.
That chip doesn't necessarily have to be in the passport. And, for example, people have demonstrated, there's some guys in the Czech Republic who have demonstrated a remote access attack where the reader talks to a kind of a man-in-the-middle device that forwards the request onto the actual passport, which can be located absolutely anywhere. And so there's no need to have the genuine passport on you at that point anymore.
Okay, so you just need, you know, the correct biometric data on the device, and away you go.
Right.
Yeah, because I've been through those automated gantries at Brisbane Airport once as well.
Right.
Which is pretty interesting, actually, coming into the country with an Australian passport and just, you know, you wave it in front of the little reader and it takes a photo and says, no worries, you are who you say you are, in you go.
Right, but again, you don't have a human being looking at the passport and saying, this is a genuine passport. Mm-hmm. I've never been through those readers.
I think it might have done some sort of scan, but still, you know, I mean, I get your point.
Right, you can basically do a man-in-the-middle attack on the passport, and the response isn't coming from the physical document you're holding, it's coming from someone else's passport, who knows where. And, you know, you've got, let's say, for example, your cell phone has an RFID transponder, and so the reader is talking to your cell phone, which is forwarding the authentication to a passport held on the other side of the world.
Well,
and, you know, there's a bunch of other problems like that too as well that have come up with this design. I mean, the people who came up with this design said, we've got all these amazing toys, we've got RFID, we've got digital signatures, let's throw all this in because it's really cool. It doesn't seem like they ever considered the change in the threat model once you do that, once you, for example, decouple the authentication from the physical document.
Yeah, yeah. What are your recommendations then, given these revelations?
Well, I guess it's not just my recommendations. It's people, security researchers all over the world have been saying this for quite some time. There was a conference done a couple of years ago in Hungary which issued some recommendations on machine-readable travel documents, which was, don't rush this stuff out without testing it. We have a very good way of assessing passports at the moment, which is the human being holding the passport and staring at you and asking you questions to make sure that you're not, you know, trying to sneak in to do who knows what. You know, consider using the existing methods and consider something that works with the existing methods rather than just throwing in a lot of technology just because it's fun.
Well, has the horse already bolted? I mean, is this pooch capable of being unscrewed?
I don't think so, no, because the political pressure behind it is such that I don't think you can stop this anymore.
Mm-hmm. So really we're going to need to roll out a new standard and, you know, make these previous e-passports obsolete?
I really don't know what's going to happen.
Okay, well, at least you're honest about it. All right, Peter Goodman, thanks a lot for your time.
Okay, thanks.
That was this week's feature guest, Peter Gutman. And finally, this week, it's time for our sponsor interview. Without our sponsors, Risky Business just wouldn't work. The reason we have great guests and, you know, what I think is interesting content anyway, is because our sponsors keep us afloat and they justify us putting time into preparing the show. So each week we get one of the sponsors on the show to share their perspective on a current event or something that's going on that's going to be interesting. And this week we're chatting to Microsoft's Jeffrey Jones. He was the Microsoft guy who put out the Vista One Year On paper in November last year. Basically, he compared the vulnerability count in Vista to the count of other operating systems, and boy, did the report draw a lot of fire. Now, not only did some in the open source community dispute Jones's numbers, but they said it was a useless metric to measure the security of an operating system by just counting the number of bugs. But as you'll hear, Jeff only used that metric when it was first used against Microsoft. It was retaliatory. Anyway, fun interview. Oh, and I should mention that the audio quality gets a little bit crappy in parts. I was using VoIP, but it does get better, so bear with it. So, Jeff, when you wrote that Vista one-year on paper, did you just, like, design the whole thing specifically to piss off every single Linux and Apple fanboy on the planet?
Only to the extent I tried to be objective and accurate in my results.
Ooh. So
you ask a question like that, I got to give you an answer like that. So why? Honestly, I publish the methodology. I publish all my sources so it can be duplicated.
Well, you did catch a lot of shit over this paper, you know, because really what it was saying is look at our bug count, it's way down. But then, you know, everyone sort of jumped up and down and said, well, you know, a vulnerability count doesn't really mean much. And there is some cred to their argument. You got to give them that.
I will say that, you know, with a lot of caveats, there, you know, you can raise some objections. But the point I'll say is we meaning Microsoft or people related to Microsoft, didn't first bring this up as a metric. The open source community offered it out as a metric. And they offered out as a metric like back in 2001, 2000 to say, oh, look, Red Hat 9 has fewer vulnerabilities in a year than Windows. Look how much better we are. I've made the methodology more rigorous. I've published it. I've got it with scientific review of peers. Few people actually dispute my numbers now.
But what do you think it actually tells us? Because, I mean, I'd hazard a guess that there are as many vulnerabilities in OS X as there are in Windows. But people just haven't got around to digging them up yet. I mean, what does a vulnerability count tell us that's useful?
Well, in one sense, I mean, one significant measure is, and the things I look at are publicly disclosed vulnerabilities that, because of that public broad public disclosure, you know, represent a certain amount of customer risk, right?
Mm.
So... In some sense, if you know, if I take two pieces of software and one of them, you know, one of them has 100 vulnerabilities disclosed and fixed, and one of them has 10 vulnerabilities disclosed and fixed, you know, the one piece of software that only had 10 versus 100, you know, their customers only had to manage risk for those 10 issues. They only had to potentially work weekends to apply fixes for those 10 issues.
Okay,
now,
so it's more about...
In theory, let's say that in addition to 10, there's 90 more that nobody discovered, nobody publicized. Those 90 just aren't representing risk in the same way as the, you know, as the 90 that were discovered and publicized.
Yeah, I mean, I know a few guys out there who like to sit on 0 days, but I take your point. So this study was more about proving the manageability aspects of... You know, trying to promote the good side of Windows rather than trying to say that it's out and out more secure.
Right. I mean, and actually, if you read any of my studies, there's whole sections dedicated to what this report does not say.
Mm.
Right. So, you know, it doesn't say. You know, it's one metric, which is one aspect, one small facet of security. It's an important one to a lot of people. You know, security administrators and those people who do that kind of management process, but. You know, as I see in my reports, I wrote. You know, let me change that answer a little bit. I wrote a paper last year that basically was, or an article that said, "What if we had zero defect software? What if all of a sudden we, Microsoft, the open source community, everybody,
was producing software that was bug-free.
That would be fantastic, because then I could ride to work on my unicorn and eat rainbows for lunch.
That would be an awesome scenario, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But the thrust, as I got in the articles, and I used some data from Zone H and referred to some other proportions that people have put out there that say, you know, how many real attacks are based on, or malware is based on vulns, how much is based on misconfigurations, on, you know, employees that have left the company, you know, inadvertent settings, mistakes, and there's a wide variety of numbers you can draw from out there, but it's roughly, I would put it somewhere between 40 to 60% of those real penetrations or instances of malware succeeding have to do with misconfigurations and things like that. So it's, even if you had vuln-free software, you had bug-free software, of the risk you need to manage on any given system, you know, 40 to 60% of it's still going to be there. You just started. And so that was more to put, is to kind of acknowledge that context, that this is only one part of, you know, when you talk about something being, quote, secure, unquote, you know, that vuln management as part of risk management is just one aspect.
So, Jeff, what are you working on now? What can we expect to see coming out?
Well, I'm going to continue to shine a bright light on the areas that I consider, you know, misperceptions with the Linux distros. And I'm largely focused on the enterprise ones, the ones that they commit to support for 7 years. But more recently, I've started adding in scrutiny of Mac Leopard, so Mac OS X as well. And I think based on the results I've, you know, haven't yet published, but I've looked at for last year and the first half of this year, I think the Linux guys are, maybe they might feel like the pressure's a little less because the Apple guys are going to feel it a little more. They have really come under a lot of scrutiny lately in terms from the researcher community, and as a result, a lot more of their, not just the quality of software issues, but also their performance. So they share a lot of issues with the Linux community, and I'm going to highlight the difference in performance between who does, you know, who provides fixes quicker, you know, and so those, I don't want to give it all away, but you can kind of, I give you the hint that that the Linux guys do look relatively good by comparison. Of course, because of my employer, people, it's an obvious, people accuse me of spinning, but I absolutely, when I see areas where I think, you know, whatever competitor is, you know, implying incorrectly or out and out asserting things that are just way off base, then I try to come up with a public methodology and counteract that. And if nothing else, it creates some lively discussion.
Yeah, and pissing off fanboys doesn't take a lot of imagination, does it?
It doesn't. It really, I could do it in a lot of simpler ways. But I guess my methods are well established and reasonably effective. So.
Now, look, just going back to this this idea of you know, comparative vulnerability analysis, is this something that you would value as a metric had it not been used against you first?
You know, I don't know. It's there's one of these things where, you know, I can't remember the quote, but you look at what you can measure, and you know, you do measure what you can and fix what you can. And I think it's one of those areas. I think it was one of the first things that other people found because it's relatively accessible, you know, in terms of public disclosures and vulnerabilities fixed. Also because you know, there's a real pain point related to it, and there is a security connection. So, you know, there are, if a customer's out there managing his enterprise and, you know, there's a critical issue that potentially raises risk for their company, he has to take action, has to do work, has to make his team work the weekend. And the scrutiny was, I understand why the scrutiny was on us first, because of how many people out there using Microsoft. But by the same token, as other people put themselves under that scrutiny, either by claiming they're better or you know, or take something like iTunes and QuickTime, where they're deploying in a really high number of desktops, then that gets scrutiny from the researchers as well. Then I just think it's a natural. As I said before, it's not a complete one. It doesn't measure security all up, but it's one aspect that people can relate to, and I think that's what draws it into the light.
All right. Well, Jeffrey Jones, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
All right. Thanks very much.
Camped on the outside of no man's land. Bring on the tragedies from some new perception.
That was Microsoft's Jeffrey Jones there, wrapping up this week's show. Taking us out this week is a fine Aussie band, Marshall and the Froe. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
No man's land. Bring on your tragedy from those who hesitate. Sure to confront that bullet snake on cut. Sure to be deep when your life is at a turn. Get up, do your thing. I'm gonna do it again. Get up, you're gonna raise your head. And I'm gonna do it again. Get up, you're gonna do your thing. I'm gonna do it again. Get up, you're gonna raise your hands up, hands up.
Raise your hands up.